Welcome. My name is Gilad Bernstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we bring together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build the world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually.
Large language models can be quite effective at the first, sensory percepts, the third, axiomatic grounding, and the fourth, creating deductions. But it's the jump. It's the creative, intuitive leap from that new concept that still requires human intuition and human input. And I don't think that's likely to change anytime soon.
As I said on a previous episode earlier this summer, there is so much going on in the world of AI that no matter how hard we try, we cannot keep up. And thus, we must rely on one another. And 3 months later, all of that is still very true. Thus, I'm thrilled to bring you another AI in the News and Current Events episode with our returning stars, Ben and Marcus. So let's get started. Thank you guys so much for joining us again. It was really wonderful to be together earlier this summer, and I think we all felt the need to continue the conversation. So I'm really grateful to both of you for being back with us. And in case any of our audience missed the first episode, maybe Marcus, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me back, Gilad. My name is Marcus Schwarting. I am the senior editor for AI and Faith, and I am a research scientist at the State University of New York in Buffalo.
Wonderful. And Ben?
My name is Ben Christensen. I build systems that help humans understand each other more often, help parents be parents. I lead partnerships for AI 2030 and for Cultural Infusions Atlas.
Wonderful. It is so wonderful to have you guys back with us. The first conversation was really wonderful, both from my perspective, but also we saw that our audience and community really engaged with it. So we're really excited to have you back. And before we dive into a few specific topics, I want to begin in a big picture, as we did last time, by talking about where AI has been in the news. And this summer has been a busy summer of AI headlines. I'm curious what's one or two things each of you are paying attention to. And Marcus, we'll have you start us off.
Sure. So I think one of the biggest headlines recently has been some of the sandbox isolation issues that have led to hacking of various systems. So we've seen information coming out from Meta as well as OpenAI about an LLM ostensibly breaking containment in order to reach some objective. On those headlines, I've been thinking a lot about what these types of assessments look like. So when you build a sandbox for testing some product, not even necessarily an AI product, there are all kinds of different boundaries that you can put up for different sorts of isolation. So one level of isolation that you might see with a large language model is you tell it, hey, don't go anywhere else, but within this little folder or this little whatever, in which case I think we've seen time and again that that's not especially effective. Another thing you can do is you can put the environment inside what's called a Docker container. And so it just explores within that little environment. There are ways that it can still get out. There are known exploits, but that's sort of one more level of sandbox isolation. There are even further levels of sandbox isolation where people explore different cyber weapons, right? So you can put code within a Docker container within a virtual machine. You can even provide physical isolation. So with a lot of these headlines, what I really want to understand better, and along the technical aspects of that, is what level of containment was actually being supplied for these sandbox environments, and how did the LLM actually breach containment? So if it was the case of thou shalt not go make a GitHub clone or whatever, then we know that to be ineffective already. If it was the case that we were seeing these much more advanced levels of sandbox isolation and the LLM was still able to breach those, that's both very interesting and quite concerning. So that's something I'm keeping an eye on, as well as just sort of doing some independent tests for myself to see exactly how open weight models like Kimi and GLM can find, say, Docker exploits, for example, when given tasks that exceed what they are capable of just within their own container.
Wonderful. Thank you. That is a really good one. And I know that in my part of the world, this has been something a lot of people have paid attention to as well. And really asking the question, as we deploy these AIs further and further into our world, how do we know what they will do? How do we know if we can control them? How do we know if they're safe? And I think that's a really important question. Ben, what's something you've been paying attention to this summer?
China has had the physical AI, another round of Olympics for robots to see who can run faster than Usain Bolt, et cetera, when it comes to robotics. And that's been an interesting thing to watch. But also, China has appeared to emerge as an unexpected leader in raising the red flag on relationships with AI replacing intimacy. That is, people are talking to AI so much of they're raising this as an issue, as a potential concern, which I find fascinating because I also saw them introducing AI use in the classroom at the age of 6 years old not too long ago. So I'm curious to see how that ends up going. And I heard from a person named Dr. Zach Stein, who called it a wave of attention hacking, which was the first wave of AI is social media, where now we're talking about attachment hacking. The gateway drug was having our attention hacked with social media, but now that, and that was the disruption of the attention system resulting in things like ADHD, but the disruption of the attachment system, how humans attach to things and each other, is now on the grade of personality disorders. So Dr. Zach Stein is calling for a chatbot first aid for parents, a frontline awareness parents might give, on the same level for children seeking social validation, on the same level as drinking or smoking or sugar, where the immediate hit of junk food is, this is awesome. The long-term hit of junk food is metabolic disorder. The immediate hit of generative AI use is, wow, this is great. But long-term anthropomorphic AI model use can result in changes to the model of a human mind. So that's what Zach is talking about, attachment hacking. So I'm really interested in the effects on well-being and health there. If I was going to look at Marcus's statement on some of these AIs breaking out, I might even say that could be considered a different dimension of AIs breaking out into our biology.
Yeah, absolutely. And as our audience knows, I've got two little kids, so that is a topic I'm thinking about a lot of, you know, how do we introduce AI to kids in a responsible way that doesn't rob them of their humanity? I think that's critical. And I'll just add that for me, one of the things I've been paying attention to is on the business side, as the Chinese models have become better and better and really are in most use cases almost as good as the flagship models we have in the United States, I have noticed my own peers and my own friends beginning to use some of these Chinese models either for cost purposes or because the Chinese models have fewer guardrails and will do things that sometimes the American models won't. And I've been paying a lot of attention to how people are kind of switching out these models. And of course, leads me to believe that we need something much more global than regulation is just one area, one country. But there's a lot happening in the world of AI. And of course, I'm so glad that we're able to share some of these highlights with our audience. Now, from there, I want to dive into a few of the topics that we maybe touched on last time, but are really core and near to those of us in the AI and faith community and to all of us who care about AI and the future of humanity. And the first is a topic that we want to talk about is kind of the future of human intelligence, and specifically think about curiosity, passion, and kind of intelligence and IQ. And Ben, I'm hoping you can start us off with this conversation. So how do you think about the future of human intelligence, and what do you think will matter in the future?
Thanks for asking. I would first look at IQ reversed, QI, being question intelligence. What is intelligence if not curiosity? When you're analyzing who is the smartest in the room or just trying to build your own intelligence, it's usually a factor of the number of questions or the quality of questions that you craft or answer. That's how it is with research institutions and certainly with researchers. And why not with children as they discover their use of the question why at that golden age when they say why all the time to the point of annoyance to their parents. But the future of human intelligence, I believe, can be called a resurgence of curiosity. And how that relates to passion, well, passion drives curiosity most often. It is apathy and entertainment or distraction that would divert an intelligent and curious mind from seeking knowledge or creating knowledge. The very act of asking a question or a query to an LLM, for example, it charms out a new moment of knowledge that is created, much like this interview. I like to think that, Gilad, the questions that you're asking us are a gift. Questions are often a gift, but in this structured setting, I end up saying things that, though I think I know them, I frame them in slightly different ways than before. And so a product of knowledge is formed because it was provoked into existence by a thoughtful and timed query from yourself. I think that's the physics of how knowledge is formed and how it works, how it disappears as well. So to the degree that we as an 8.2 billion person cohort are raising our question intelligence or our curiosity velocity, That's the degree to which the future of human intelligence progresses. In the language of my faith tradition, from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we study the books of Christianity, and I could even look at the Bible in a summary. To me, it means ask better questions, seek and ye shall find, ask and it shall be opened unto you. And then in the Book of Mormon, we get this warning. But if you don't ask, you're left to perish in the dark, not because the answers weren't there, but because you didn't ask. And I feel like we have all the data at our fingertips. That was true before this age of AI. That was an internet age type of a thing. But now the queries which we choose to ask or do not ask, both to the LLMs around us and to the deities or the sources of all knowledge, which everyone has the right to look to, determine the intelligence that we're able to build upon. That's how I look at curiosity and intelligence and passion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Marcus, bringing you into this, you know, there used to be this kind of organic differentiation in human intelligence. It used to be that one of us was a better analyst than the other two of us, and we could be better at that. One of us maybe was a better writer than the other two of us, we could be better at that. But of course, we know that Claude is an amazing analyst, and Claude is a pretty good writer. And thus, it seems with time, some of these natural differentiations that existed in human intelligence will begin to wane, at least things like analytical ability and whatever. So, you know, like Ben said, it seems to me like things like passion, curiosity, you know, creativity are kind of what's left. But how do you think about it? What do you think about the future of human intelligence? And what do you think will matter in the future?
You know, I think that looking at continued scientific discovery and developments, I think that those will predominantly still be driven by human beings. A lot of societal progress are things that might be aided to some degree by an LLM, but I don't think they'll ever be driven by an LLM. So there's a really great paper that came out, I believe it was in iClear this year, by Tom Zahavi out of Google DeepMind. The title of the paper was LLMs Can't Jump, which I thought was quite clever. And Zahavi was bringing this core argument that Albert Einstein made to describe scientific discovery, which I think could also be applied to other human endeavors like curiosity and overall societal progress. He broke it down into four steps. So there's sensory experience. There's perceiving one's environment, this real world, messy, physical environment. The second is the jump, as some creative, intuitive leap that drives us towards a new concept. From there, we get an axiomatic foundation. We lay down these rules, these mathematical abstractions. And then from there, we can deduce. We can start proving theorems and testing predictions. So what Zahavi argues for, and I think shows pretty effectively, is large language models can be quite effective at the first, sensory percepts, the third, axiomatic grounding, and the fourth, creating deductions. But it's the jump. It's the creative, intuitive leap from that new concept that still requires human intuition and human input. And I don't think that's likely to change anytime soon.
Yeah, I love that. There's something within there that I always think about human expertise and, you know, the Christian concept of embodiment and the idea that the fact that we are embodied actually gives us these other senses, these other connections to the real world around us beyond our intellect, beyond our IQ. And there's something in there that really resonates with me as we think about, you know, I would say, right, human intelligence is more than IQ. And then there's these other pieces of it, like you touched on, that are really important. So Ben, how do you think about this? And also, if you could add to your thoughts, you know, when we first connected, you talked about curiosity and cultural intelligence as social infrastructure. So maybe tell us a little more about that. And how do all these things kind of fit together?
Thanks. So when I introduce myself as Ben Christensen, I often give them my real first name, Fleming, which I don't go by because it registers as a last name everywhere in the world. But I bring it up more often these days because I'm named after my Danish grandfather, Fleming. Denmark is where it's a first name. And in our age, curiosity about one's own cultural truth and each other's cultural truth becomes an amplifier for how humans can connect with each other and might just be vital for the future of how we connect with each other in the age of AI, discovering more dimensions to our cultural truth. So cultural intelligence, I'll frame in the words of Carl Jung. The meeting of two personalities is like the contact of two chemicals. If there's any reaction, both are changed. So when we're interacting, if we have any interaction at all, I come away with a different dimension of my person as if I'm some sort of multifaceted crystal illuminated because of who you are uniquely. And I subscribe to that belief, and I think it's a fitting metaphor for the cultural identities and the truths of each one of the people on this planet, but only to the degree that we're curious about what shapes each other's cultures and minds and backgrounds. This helps. Where I see that is significant in AI is my world gets changed. The way I speak changes when I interact with AI. It makes me think different, makes me write differently. I publish differently, knowing an AI, not just people, will read what I'm writing because it may get approximated or summarized or ingested into a machine that will be used to quantify me in some way. And that shaping, I realize, is a perfect example of socio-technical systems where society shapes technology, which shapes society. So when it comes to the field of understanding humanity, cultural intelligence is about turning anthro data into organizational intelligence. That can be used to create value socially or economically. And it's a key to a stronger strategy in a workplace based on the richness of who we are, discovering that. So it's curiosity for self, it's curiosity for the world around us, but especially the immeasurable depths of who we are as people. And I see that in 16 years of marriage as well. There's still one of the greatest gifts of generosity I can give my spouse is that I could be surprised by a new dimension of who she is that I haven't found out about yet due to lack of curiosity or due to the new combustion of how she is evolving as a person because of her embodied experiences, not just with me. And I hope, and that's one of my greatest gifts that I'd love for other people to give me as well, the opportunity that I might be different than who they expected me to be yesterday, as we're all evolving. When it comes to the system of cultural intelligence as national infrastructure, that is more identifying disinformation as a bioweapon. And if we're talking about a community or national immune system, the instrumentation of curiosity through that community can bolster the whole health of the system because there are cultural identities that are better understood and more healthy and better ways for understanding to be found between the humans in that group as well as the technologies which get calcified as political instruments as well. So that's where it becomes cultural intelligence as national infrastructure. In other words, it's the hidden truths within us and around us that are more insidious, if they stay hidden, than the false truths that we get from hallucinations or simple miscommunications. Therefore, curiosity is the remedy to the virus of incuriosity, which is a default in the age of entertainment and AI.
Absolutely. That was a beautiful answer. And it's actually a really perfect transition to the next topic I wanted to talk about, which is AI and art. And you know, there's so many things I loved about what you just said there. And one of them in particular reminds me of a quote from Dr. John Gottman, who is a relationship researcher who beautifully married his Jewish faith and, you know, a lot of empirical research he did over a lifetime as an academic. And he talked about that the magic of a long-term relationship is falling in love over and over again, but always with the same person. There's something beautiful that you said in there about rediscovering who your wife is as she changes, as we change, that I think is really distinctly human and really is a part of everything that all of us have said about the future of intelligence being passion-driven, creativity-driven, spirit-driven, heart-driven, and of course being a place of creativity, which is why it's such a perfect transition into the conversation about AI and art. Now, both of you are married to artists, which is pretty cool. So my first question, maybe Marcus, you'll go first. Tell us a little bit about what your wife does in the fields of art, and then how does she think about AI coming into the field of creativity and art?
Sure. So my wife and I are here in St. Andrews, Scotland. She is pursuing her PhD in the Divinity School, a pretty special program called Imagination, Theology, and the Arts. So she is co-advised on a project that is investigating the poet Ruth Pitter. Pitter was a non-Christian when she started writing her poetry, right around the time of the Blitz in London. She would cross a bridge every day to work in the munitions plant, and then she would in the evenings be hunkered down with everyone else as the bombs were falling. And that experience really led her to exploring her faith and eventually hearing C.S. Lewis's radio show, converting to Christianity. And there's sort of this beautiful through line of her poetry starting to embrace different aspects of Jesus's resurrection or eternal salvation, these types of aspects. And that theology in that poetry is what my wife Melody is really exploring over the course of this 3-year PhD. In terms of her own attitudes around artificial intelligence, I've actually helped her to make sure that all of the AI features are turned off on her machines. So she uses DuckDuckGo, and I made sure that the AI generation portion is turned off. She knows, obviously, what I do pretty well and my engagement with large language models, but also a variety of other different types of AI models. And I think for her, it's just not something that she's really invested in or interested in exploring at the moment. However, I will say that I have been able to help her through optical character recognition, that is, machine learning models and deep learning models that take scanned text and convert it into a searchable document. So I think that's been pretty fruitful for her and her research, as well as for some other researchers here at St. Andrews.
Absolutely. And Ben, tell us a bit about your wife and her art.
Thanks. My wife is a singer-songwriter, a pop star from Finland. She released 3 albums with Sony Music years before I met her. I thought I was the singer of the two of us, to be honest, when we met, but I was wrong. She's a professional. Her latest album is called Sound Mind, and it's her first English, therefore international album. And it's about mental health awareness, which is a stigma to talk about in Finland. And she goes boldly and sings about it. It's also about her own personal journey and the highs and lows dealing with mental illness. So there's songs like The More I Learn, The Less I Know, which is like a requiem for when you're pursuing more knowledge and you're getting through the Dunning-Kruger effect and you start to feel crushed with the new worlds of knowledge that you recognize that you don't know anymore. It's a beautiful paradox, but it can cause a bit of depression as well. Another one is Still Breathing. When you feel like you can't breathe, but you're still breathing, you could just take one step ahead. That's something that goes through. But there's also the high points, finding joy and beauty in the little things that can make you smile, the gifts all around you. And she takes note of these things and documents her relationship with her mind and the people in her life. I find it as an emotional expression. It's electroacoustic pop, I would say, by the way, by genre. So however that lands for you, that's how I like to describe it. But it's pop with some R&B, some soul really wrapped in it. Those are some of her backgrounds there. She's really passionate about making a difference in raising awareness on these topics. The role of AI as an amplifier to producing new music comes up controversially. Some ways it helps augment the capabilities that she's been doing on her own label. In other ways, it's just interesting, if not distracting. Because the real work comes by the creation of instigating. I would liken it to what Marcus was saying about in the research field, humans driving the core questions. And those will be here as well. So,
yeah, absolutely. You know, I speak a lot in Los Angeles, and the question of creativity and AI is almost always the first question I get after my talk is done. And, you know, I really like EDM music, electronic dance music. And for a long time now, people have said, well, that's not really art in the same way that other kinds of music might be art, because they're using these computers and these knobs and these software and whatever to create it. And of course, I did not accept that as a valid critique of that kind of music, because of course, what the artist brought was their emotion, was their feeling, was their intuition of the human experience, were all these things that I think are uniquely human. And what I enjoyed when I was in the audience, even though, yes, there's no live musicians performing instruments or whatever on stage. But of course, I use this example because the line is not a bright line in the sand between when you are moving the knobs and when the AI is moving the knobs. And there is some line, some philosophical, theoretical line somewhere beyond which the creativity now is lesser of the humans and more of the AI, and probably another line somewhere further away where the creativity is mostly or all the human or all the AI and not the human. So asking both of you, how do you think about this invisible line? How do you think about human creativity? What does your faith kind of bring into this with the concept of creativity and whatnot? So Ben, how do you think about that?
Well, I love remix and remix culture. Pablo Picasso is credited to have said, good artists borrow, great artists steal. And in this case, I would look at whatever elements are available, how do you remix them, even if they are existing melodies from another bit there? This was a study that I had on new media and communication at the IT University of Copenhagen about 15 years ago, and it's more relevant today with AI, because remixing is part of the fabric of where we're in, so much that we don't often get to trace where all the remixing comes from. But using that is fascinating. I would use two artists, for example, Mozart and Sufjan Stevens. What do they have in common? Well, let me start with Sufjan Stevens. His first few albums were plucky instruments that he played himself, and then he came up with The Age of Odds. It's an album that is heavily electronic and using all sorts of computer equipment with very complex layers. And that Sufjan Stevens comment was, I think Beethoven would have been using these just as well if he had them at his time. And I would liken that to Mozart as well, where I regard Mozart as someone who had gifts of creativity, even inspired from God, that he was able to utilize and give, and is now known as a master of music composition. I would put the thought experiment of having Mozart, if he had access to all the spectrum of tools of our time, would he not use them as prolifically as he did the tools of his time? And would that make him any less Mozart if there was a magic flute EDM remix that he did or something like this? So I'm of the opinion that all these remixing culture, and I'm building on what you said, Marcus, because it was fascinating. That's where I'm looking at that.
Yeah, and Marcus, how do you think about this, like I said, invisible bright line of where the creativity goes from the human to the machine and how we think about that?
You know, I don't know if the line is quite as clear for me. One thing I've noticed is when I listen to AI-generated music, especially in a genre I'm not really familiar with. So I was recently listening to a good deal of lo-fi, and I was listening to Lo-Fi Girl and some of these other artists specifically to try and hone my capacity for classifying whether or not a lo-fi song is AI generated or not, because that's another area where you're seeing a lot of this AI generated content. And, you know, I think to somebody who doesn't know the genre very well, it's very hard to tell. So I was just putting something on autoplay and noticing like, oh, wait a second, there's something just not quite right here. And sure enough, it's 3 months old and is from somebody where you're click on their page and you're not quite sure where that's all coming from. So for me, I wonder if for a casual observer, they might not pick up on that. But for somebody who really cares about the art form, there is a much stronger, much clearer line. Thinking of jazz, for example, as well. Folks who really know and understand jazz, I'm sure can pick up on AI-generated jazz very distinctly. Mistakes made by human beings, or what seeming mistakes made by human beings, are very different from mistakes or seeming mistakes made by a generative tool.
Yeah, absolutely. Please, Ben.
Speaking of LA and picking up on elements that are made by humans or AI, Sean Meyer is a multi-platinum producer. And recently, I had the chance to meet him. He's the CEO of a company called Verified. Besides being an established and decorated creator in the music business, Verified, VRFD, is about being able to trace the elements of a project that were created by a human in a mixed composition of AI. So I found that fascinating as originating from someone as prolific as Sean Meyer.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the things that I find most interesting in this conversation about AI and creativity and art is that so far we have largely talked about it from the perspective of the creator of the art and not from sort of the consumer of the art. And I think there's a lot of interesting questions of for what purpose or for what value are we consuming the art? And as the consumer of the art, is there really a material difference for us when we consume a song made by AI versus a song made by a person if the feels feel similarly?
And if it helps me process an emotion at an appropriate time. I'm thinking of EDM, and my toddler has no, well, his body, his mind will respond similarly, at least to my measurement capabilities. He'll start dancing to anything that moves, anything with a beat. So to him, it's a functional, if he was choosing that purpose, good, this is something I can move to and dance to. So as an adult, though, I can relate. I may not be able to tell the difference.
Yeah. And
emotionally, I may not care if it evokes the emotional processing that I'm hoping to either celebrate or mourn with. Usually EDM is for celebrating.
Totally. And for me, I actually think that songs may be the first medium to fall, for lack of a better analogy. Because I feel pretty certain that if one of us recommended a book right now to the audience and the audience found out it was written by AI, the chance that they read it just drops dramatically. Whereas if you're out for a run and that song comes on your Spotify playlist that gives you those feels that you want to feel when you're going on the run, you're just going to thumbs up. You're not going to do any research about who composed it or who wrote the music. So it's interesting to think about both the type or the medium of art, but also the consumer versus the creator of the art and what they're trying to do with it, which makes this conversation so complicated.
It affects trust and interest when you classify. Classifications have consequences, right? You're right. My interest in reading an AI-generated book goes down if I find out that it's written by a human.
And frankly, if I don't tell you, you might feel like I'm deceiving you. It might feel like an important detail that I should have included when I recommended the book. Whereas like if it was like a normal human author, you wouldn't expect me to give you the entire biography of everything this author's ever done. But it does feel, including to me, it feels a little bit almost deceptive. Marcus, how do you think about this whole thing?
I was thinking as well about the likelihood and the susceptibility of individuals, even individuals who are sort of used to distinguishing between AI-generated versus human-generated content, of making either type one errors, they think something is AI when it's not, and type two errors, probably more common, they take something as that was generated by an AI as being generated by a human being. Thinking of the three mediums, maybe four mediums that are the most commonly used. So you've got text, you've got images, and then you've got video and audio. Text is by far just mechanically the easiest to reproduce, right? So we're still seeing issues with image and video and audio generation that makes it very apparent. So somebody could be watching an AI-generated video and then just immediately going, oh, that's not right. Or looking at an AI-generated image and just on cursory inspection, oh, you know, the cat has four legs or five legs or what have you. With text, it's so much more difficult. And I wonder if we've sort of grown acclimated to not knowing the difference between human-generated, AI-generated, and some hybrid in between, because unfortunately, there's really not a good way to tell. And I don't think that Anthropic watermarks are really going to fix it either.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, the watermark can be just as easily removed as it can be added. And I sadly agree. And it's the same thing you hear sometimes people talk about. AIs can detect content created by other AI. To me, that feels like a short-term solution at best, maybe not even an actual solution. Because it's very hard to ultimately tell, you know, what was created by what as the AIs get a lot better. Now, before we run out of time, I do want to just spend 1 or 2 minutes talking about AI governance and responsible deployment of AI, which, of course, is completely related to the conversation we're just having about art and disclosure. And I always share that, you know, I was fortunate to spend some time at the Allen Institute, the Paul Allen Artificial Intelligence Research Institute, and they put out some guidelines for their own views about AI regulation. And one of them is AI demasking. The idea is that you should know if you're interacting with a human entity or with a non-human entity out there. So as you guys think about this giant area of responsible AI deployment and AI governance, Ben, starting with you, in circles where you are in the UN and other important circles, how are people talking about these?
Who has paid or unpaid labor in their organization? And how should an AI agent who's working on behalf of a human somewhere get compensated? It builds on the last question that you had. If reading is learning and writing is thinking, and I'm reading a book thinking that I'm learning about the results of someone's thinking, if you wrote the book, Gilad, then I might want to connect with you about it afterwards to meet the mind behind the writing. If it's an AI that created that, even from a prompt, then I have less of, feel like I'm going into a void of space if I chase that back to the writer, a vacuum of intellectual thought in a way, because it's untraceable and therefore also has a different compensation expectation in this future economy. And some of the circles that I'm in, I was leading a workshop on AI work in the economy at Notre Dame 2 weeks ago, and this was the topic that came up as well, is accounting for unpaid or paid labor that is done by humans or their AI agents at scale. We came up with more questions than answered, but we did settle on the dignity of the worker as the primary indicator of success.
Absolutely. And this is a good week, of course, to bring that up, as just the other day, Bill Gates put out his own framework for some of these things, including a token tax that he believes should be applied to people's utilization of AI within business to replace things like payroll taxes and other taxes that human laborers pay to fund our system and to fund our government. And within his proposal were also specific professions and specific roles that he thought should be legally protected from AI encroachment. And it was very interesting to read that, and I think very much connected to what you're talking about.
The other side of it is user and verification. That is to say, open verification of the work that got done, where a lot of verification, if it happens on the vendor side of proving what processes were completed by what agents, if that's in a proprietary system, the end users don't have a way to verify what happens. So having a standard for open verification is something that Tricia Wong and the advancedaisociety.org are working on creating. And I think that is a very significant infrastructure for governance, AI governance for enterprises, for nation states, for anybody who is going to be working in an agentic and human co-working era.
Absolutely. One more related to that, it comes from Ornette Sione, who was the founding CEO at the Allen Institute. So when I was AI2, Ornette Sione, who was the founding CEO of the Institute, also talked about AI auditability and the fact that AI really is a black box, and people outside of academia and the technical field sometimes don't understand that it really is hard to go into the model and to say, why did you choose this answer versus that answer? And his response to that is AI auditability. The fact that we as a public and that we as consumers of this AI should have the ability to audit the AI from an outside before we adopt it, before we integrate it, to know if it's really performing in the way that we want. So I think that's another amazing regulation that connects to that. Now, Marcus, when you are in academic circles, what are they thinking about in terms of responsible deployment of AI and AI governance?
Sure. Well, so for starters, I think it's been really heartening to see so many professional organizations who are starting to have really nuanced standards, thinking of ISO standards and IEEE standards and SOC 2 standards that are all verifying how vendors are interacting with suppliers and making sure that everyone is sort of beholden to sets of principles and rules for when and how to use these in a business setting. So I think that's been really good to see. Regulation often borrows from those ISO, IEEE standards. So I think it's interesting to see, especially in the EU, how that's being shaped, even by mostly just volunteers who are willing to really think through these types of regulations. In terms of academics, I think it's been interesting to see how different journals have responded to the use of AI for paper writing, for code writing. For example, NeurIPS, which is one of the largest AI conferences, said it's okay if your code is AI generated, so long as it's validated and is working. But if you use AI for writing the paper itself, now we've got a problem. And that is grounds not just for the paper being rejected, but for even stronger actions to be taken.
That is fascinating.
Build on the IEEE, there's one of those standards. I love that you said, Marcus, that regulation does borrow from some of those that are developed. IEEE standard 7012, aka MyTerms, which can be found at myterms.info, is a fascinating standard which helps people scope how their data will interact with the agents coming at them from municipalities or corporations. It's like having a Screen Actors Guild for everyone on Earth. That is to say, your name, image, and likeness get to become part of a contract that you or your authorized personal AI agent can now proactively go out and counter offer a signed document that's coming at you. And I think that's a significant new skill for folks, much like a personal will at the end of your life, but a living will during the now of your life in the age of AI.
Absolutely. I think that is a really wonderful one. We absolutely should all own our likeness and our identity and our voice. Thank you guys so much for joining us. These conversations are really valuable for our community as there is so much happening in the world of artificial intelligence, and it's hard for any of us to keep up. So we're so grateful to have people like yourselves in our community able to share what you're paying attention to and what you're focused on. Before I let you go, as you know by now, we have a lightning round, 3 simple questions, 15 seconds apiece, and Ben, you're going to kick us off. What is one thing that you read or did this summer that brought you meaning?
I brought my child to the Senate to have him speak with me, and I brought another child to the UN when I went to go speak, and I brought a child to Notre Dame when I went to go speak, not out of necessarily design, but necessity, as I'm figuring out ways to deal with being a parent. And you know, it focused my identity as what I do, as building systems to help people understand each other. I focus that now to build systems to help parents parent and become better parents, because I need not just myself, but those in my community to be supported by systems which will help them rise.
We all do. Absolutely. And Marcus?
Sure. So I think the last time I was on the podcast, I mentioned that I was reading a book called The Feast by Margaret Kennedy. Oh my goodness, it's become my new favorite book. It's just really well written. And it's been a month or so since I finished it, but I just keep coming back to and thinking about how she crafts these characters, how they're interacting with one another, how she's really drawing the reader into this sort of Eucharistic participation.
I love that. For me, I'd watched the show, The Three Body Problem, a while ago, but I read the book this summer. And the book, for people don't know, is really about the question of what do we do when we know there's this existential threat coming a long time from now? And similarly to what Marcus said, it's one of those things I've just kept thinking about because, of course, AI is coming and it's coming sort of slowly and sort of quickly, but it is coming to change our world. And that really resonated with me. Next question. And Marcus, you're going to go first. As we enter fall, what is one more thing you hope to accomplish or learn before the end of the year?
I've got a lot of different really awesome projects that are sort of spinning up in the fall. So one that's been taking a lot of my time recently is I've been looking at this class of chemicals called PFAS, sometimes called forever chemicals, specifically around remediation methods. And so there's a lot of folks who are looking at how these PFAS molecules break down actually under, like, people will light a plasma, for example, to break these molecules down. So I've been really interested in using AI to help discover how these break down and whether they're actually being converted into something that's less environmentally harmful.
I love it. And Ben?
I met a person named Perla Khatar who's publishing a paper on quantum privacy, a pioneering combination, as she described it. And Glenn Weil recently put together the 16 societal implications of AI and challenged us in a conversation, what are the 16 social implications of quantum and privacy? How is that articulated? 16 being just a number. But I'd be really interested to explore that a bit further, especially in context of the Ajax Institute, where I'm a senior fellow, but their mission is to mitigate AI threats to democratic societies. And I would love to see how quantum will fit in there. I feel like that's Marcus's topic, really.
Absolutely. And then final question, Ben, you're going to go first. What is one of your favorite traditions that you do at the end of the year?
Oh, favorite traditions? Making Finnish food. So my wife is Finnish. I have Danish food traditions. We have this Nordic casserole that we make called porkkanalaatikko, and I'll make it during the Thanksgiving and the Christmas season. And I think to myself every year, why don't we make this all year long? Why do we save our best food this time of year? That's what I'll be doing.
That sounds delicious. And Marcus?
So my wife and I have this tradition where on Christmas Eve, after the Christmas Eve service we attend, we give each other one present early, and we each give each other a book that we've selected for the other. And then we sit together and read our books on Christmas Eve and stay up a little bit later. And that's something that I always look forward to.
I love that. Well, thank you both so much for joining us, and thank you for all the positivity you put into the world. And of course, thank you to all of you in the AI and faith community for joining us for another conversation. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more conversations and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We are on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us.